Welcome to Clark County Today. I'm your host, David Medore, and today our guest is Larry Patella, Commander Larry Patella. Larry, we want to know about your background. You have served for some time in the military, and well, let's get to know you a little bit. You're one of our distinguished senior citizens, and I want to make sure that the community knows who you are. You've been very actively involved in our local community, and we want to be able to see some of your background.
Well, I think a lot of people know who I am, but I did. I spent 31 years in the United States Navy, and probably one of the best things that ever happened to me. I really enjoyed being in the Navy, and that was a very fulfilling life.
And you signed up as an enlisted man?
I did. I signed up as an enlisted man. I did something very stupid. I quit high school in my senior year with only 1 month left to go and joined the Navy.
Why did you do that?
Just on a spur of the moment.
Were you not at war during the time? Or
no. Well, it was right at the end of World War II.
Okay. So and, right at the end. You mean during the war?
1947.
Before it had finished?
No, it was just 1947.
Okay.
And another fellow and I, we were just playing hooky from school one day, and one of us said, let's join the Navy. So we went down and joined the Navy, and after I got in the Navy, I realized what a mistake I had made, and so I wrote to the school, got my high school diploma, and spent probably the next 20 years going to a college at night whenever we were in port or doing whatever, and got a degree. And
so you finished your degree while you were in the Navy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. This was, now when you went into the Navy, you went through boot camp like
I went through boot camp.
People normally do.
Yeah, went through boot camp and
you started at the bottom, as a seaman.
I started right at the very. I was what they call an E-1, which is a recruit, and I worked my way up to be a chief radarman, a chief petty officer.
Radar men. So, in other words, you went through some technical training
right. In
order to know how to operate the radar equipment.
Right. Well, matter of fact, I had a double dose. I went to a sonarman school first. Right after I got out of boot camp, I went to sonar school. And after sonar school, which was a 6 month electronic school, I went to a ship, and the ship got a mandatory quota to send one person to radarman school. And there were only two people on board ship that had high enough, what we call GCTs and ARIs. And so the other gentleman was senior to me, so I was selected and I went to radar school. So then I went to radar school. And
in other words, they took the more junior man.
Right.
That they didn't want to spare the one. In other words,
I was
How'd you feel about that? You feel
it was fine with me. And I wound up being a radarman. Advanced through the rank to chief petty officer.
So you must have enjoyed it.
Oh, I enjoyed it very much. And then
chief petty officer, that's like E1, 2, 3, how?
That's E7.
E7. So and how long a time you went from E1 to E7?
Took me 7 years.
That's a pretty good clip.
Yeah, it was about minimum amount of time that you can do it. And so I got to
So you already had a high achiever record right from the beginning, it sounds like.
So I decided that, what do I do now? So I applied for a commission, and I passed the test and went to Officer's Candidate School, and got commissioned as an ensign.
Really? So you went from the highest ranking position you can have as a enlisted man is chief petty officer?
In those days, that was as high as you go, but later on, they added two more pay grades onto that.
When you were there, you maxed it out. You got as high as you can get in the enlisted, and then you applied for an officer program.
Right.
You were accepted into that, and then you went, there must have been some schooling involved in that.
I went to Officers Candidate School in Newport, Rhode Island.
Okay.
We used to call it a knife and fork school. Teach you how to eat with a knife and fork. It was very a very strenuous school, but very very interesting and very exciting for me.
So your training consisted of following orders, being precise, and what all did they teach you during that
school? Well, you learn all about the different aspects. You have a few weeks of gunnery type information. You have a few weeks of engineering and what goes on below decks and on board a ship.
So they expose you to all the different positions?
Expose you all the different factions that you're going to find on board ship.
And you graduated in that, and from then you were an ensign, which is an officer, and that required everybody, all the enlisted men to salute you. And they,
And I was assigned to a destroyer.
And where was the destroyer?
The destroyer was operating out of Norfolk, Virginia. And I was assigned to a destroyer, and from there I went to shore duty in Virginia as a what they call an air intercept controller. That was the days before we had all these radars on board airplanes. People like me would direct our aircraft in a position to where he could shoot down the enemy aircraft.
In other words, you had access to radar, radar,
right?
And the aircraft couldn't carry radar, so you would look on your screen and you would relay them via radio where the aircraft were headed that direction.
And I would tell them how to get there and what speed to go and all of those various things. And from there, I went to an aircraft carrier.
What was that carrier?
It was the USS Princeton. It was an old World War II carrier that they converted into an amphibious aircraft carrier.
And what is an amphibious aircraft carrier?
That's one that carries pretty much almost a battalion of Marines and a lot of helicopters for what you would call vertical envelopment. When instead of invading an enemy shore by boats, you do it by air.
Okay, so you carried basically aircraft that would land. Would they parachute or how would they get?
No, they would land on the shore.
Using helicopters?
In the helicopters.
Was this before they actually had fixed wing aircraft that could land on carriers?
No. This was during the same time. This was a special.
In the 40s or the 19?
This was in the 50s and early 60s.
Okay, all right. So we're, well, all right. Yeah, yeah. So not that far back.
Not that far back. And so, then from there, I went to the, I got command of the USS Jennings County.
You said command of?
Yeah.
In other words, you were given a command, you were the captain of the ship at that point?
I became the commanding officer of it. And it was the first ship to be, that was designed to support river operations in the Vietnam Delta, and I had.
Was this during the Vietnam War?
During the Vietnam War, I had two helicopters on board and 10 river patrol boats, and my job was to patrol up and down the rivers and interdict the bad guys from using the rivers.
So there, during the Vietnam War, you were a commander of your own ship in wartime, and your job was to patrol enemy territory, and you handed me some pictures here. Is one of these pictures?
The smaller one is the Jennings County.
Okay,
and it was specially configured to. You see, it's got a flight deck there, and where the helicopters would carry and. And on the side here, you probably can't see it, but we had booms on the side where we had fiberglass river patrol boats that would tie up to them, and we would steam up and down the rivers, dragging the boats with us and the helicopters on board, and our boats would go out on patrol, and the helicopters would if they got in trouble, our helicopters would get airborne and come to their rescue. And
did you actually engage the enemy?
Yes, we had. More engagement than I care to think about.
That right? So that must have been a challenge for you and a challenge for your men.
It was very challenging.
Did any men lose their lives during that?
Yes, time? we had a few fatal casualties.
That must have. I can't imagine what that must be like.
It's a terrible thing. And of course, then you have to write a letter to the parents and explain.
And you ended up having to do that?
I did that, several times.
Are those memories fresh with you?
Oh, yeah. I don't think you'd ever forget those things.
Mm-hmm. So. And how long did you serve aboard that ship?
That was, I served there for a year, doing that for a year. Mm-hmm. And then my boss, who was an admiral, was the commander of the amphibious force Pacific Fleet, asked me if I would extend my tour in Vietnam and become part of the river operations where they had the 9th Infantry Division. He wanted me to learn that part of it. And so I naturally accepted. And he wanted me to be his special warfare officer when I came back to the United States. So I spent another 2 months with the 9th Infantry Division down in the Delta, crawling through rice paddies and putting up.
So you're not on a ship at this time. You're actually like the Army.
It was with the 9th Infantry Division, and they were doing search and destroy missions.
Is that Marines or is that Air Force? Army.
No, U.S. Army.
Okay. So you're actually out there with did you engage the enemy at that time?
Oh, yeah, a few times, yeah.
So you're on the ground and out in the ship out there during the Vietnam War.
Right. Mm.
Were you ever wounded?
No, I was very fortunate.
You must have been shot at.
I think good Lord was looking after me.
Yeah, you're still here. Be thankful for that. So how long did you spend in that situation? Were you out there in the rice paddies crawling
around?
Just
to get a good feel for it, and then I came back and spent 2 years on the staff of the Commander Amphibious Force Pacific Fleet, and then from that job I went to command another larger LST, a larger and newer LST.
What's an LST?
It's a landing ship tank.
Okay, you gave me there's another.
Smaller. It's a larger version of that smaller one there.
Okay. Yeah. And now I have one other picture here. You tell me when to bring that up.
Okay. And so I had that, and I had one of the most interesting tours on that ship. I was assigned to demonstrate a Boeing hydrofoil to all the NATO nations.
A hydrofoil. How big was that?
It was 50 feet long, and it actually flew through the water.
Was that new back then?
It was very new, very.
So back then that was new technology.
Was
that the late 60s?
And this thing would do about 50 or 60 knots on its struts, on its wings. And my job was to demonstrate it to all the NATO nations because they were trying to develop a NATO hydrofoil. But the interesting part of that was that we were going to go to all of these wonderful and interesting countries throughout Europe and the western part of Asia. And mm-hmm. So I had an idea, and so I wrote a letter via the chain of command to the chief of naval operations and said, you know, as long as we're going to all these wonderful places, wouldn't it be nice if we could embark our wives and on board and between these ports? Mm-hmm. And I got approval to do that. So we started off our tour in Copenhagen. Then we went to England. We went to three ports.
With your wives?
We took our wives between ports.
Okay.
We went from Copenhagen to Portsmouth, England, and the wives were allowed to ride on board. As soon as they got on board, then we have to put them ashore, and they go live in hotels or whatnot.
Do they ever do that these days?
No, they don't do that anymore. There was a lot of resistance from some of the higher-ups in the Navy because they didn't want those women on board ships.
What was your experience? Is it you felt like that was great?
Or? Oh, it was wonderful. It was just great. And the sailors just loved it. A lot of sailors had their wives on board, and we had wives cooking in the galley and providing meals, and it was just delightful.
So that was a significant change in the diet, huh?
Yeah, so we went all the way from England and to France and to Turkey, Spain, and... So we spent 7 months demonstrating this hydrofoil to all the NATO nations.
And during that 7 months, your wives are riding between ports?
Right, they're riding between
ports. Are you aware that that has ever happened at any time since
I don't think
then?
That's ever happened again.
So
in the
you
Navy.
Set the precedent here that's when it comes so to so getting so your right, wives right, to ride on board.
Right. And then from there, I went to be the executive officer on another ship called the USS Duluth. And I was the executive officer there, and we took part in the evacuation of Vietnam. And we stayed out there in about 80 miles off the coast, and we took thousands of of people.
The Duluth. That's not, is that this picture?
No, I don't have a picture of Duluth.
Okay. What size ship was that?
It's bigger. It's just a little bit bigger than the next one we're going to look at. It's what we called an LPD, which is a landing ship platform.
How many people could it carry?
Oh, about 1,000.
1,000 people. And yeah. You're the commander of this ship?
I was the executive officer.
Executive officer, okay.
And we evacuated probably about 3,500 people from Vietnam.
And that was at the, wrapping up the war?
Wrapping up the war.
Is that why you're evacuating? You're pulling the troops out? The people that you're evacuating were troops?
No, they were civilians.
Okay.
Mostly civilians.
And they would ferry them via helicopter?
They came out in helicopters, boats, life rafts, anything they could. Lost a lot of people out there, but we took them after we got them all on board. We took them to Subic Bay in the Philippines, and we let them off and we dropped them off there, and then I don't know what the government did with them after that, but I'm sure a lot of them came to the United States, or a lot of them went to Guam and other places, so that was very exciting, but also very sad because there was a lot of people that were just in dire straits.
You mean that wanted to leave?
Well, they were not wanting to leave Vietnam, and we had such things as fixed wings aircraft trying to land alongside the ship in the water because they were just so trying to get out of South Vietnam.
So it was an emergency situation. There was little time. People were fleeing. It was almost like a rescue operation.
Right, it was a rescue operation. And then from there, I went to Mount Vernon, which is that big photograph there.
Okay, now I can bring out your big photograph.
Yeah, bring that big photograph out there. Then went to the Mount Vernon, and I became the commanding officer of that ship there.
All right.
And the difference between that ship and the previous one was this carried more equipment and less troops, and the other one, the Duluth, carried more troops and less equipment.
About how long is that ship?
This ship here is about 600 feet long, and it's about 80 foot width beam and probably 15,000 tons.
Wow, so that's two football fields long, and this is a smaller one than the one, the rescue ship that you were XO
of. The rescue ship was a little bit bigger than this one. Oh, anyway, but
and what was your position on this ship again?
On this one here, I was a commanding officer of this one.
Okay. And did you find that challenging? You feel like to be given the command of a ship, because that's a lot of responsibility.
It's a lot. You've got thousands of hundreds of lives in your hand,
and you felt like you could handle that.
Oh yes, yeah.
And you rose to the. Yeah. You felt like the challenge. You enjoyed the serving that way.
I enjoyed serving that way, and that's one of the things I liked about the Navy was that you could become a commanding officer ship and. You follow the rules and regulations, you get to make all the decisions, and as long as you keep the boss informed of what you're doing and don't violate any basic rules or regulations, you're like the letter I got from the Chief of Naval Operations said, you're allowed to lose your own ingenuity, you're allowed to do what you think is best, and just tell the boss
So you had a lot of freedom, a lot of autonomy. You basically were the commander of the ship, and you had the basic mission and the guidelines to follow, but you had to be a decision maker to be able to call the shots and get the job done.
Right.
And so what we have here, this is from Admiral Moore. Am I saying that correctly?
Right.
And he basically, I think it's too long for me to read, but he goes on. I read it before we started this interview here. And he's very complimentary to you. Yeah. And he says he doesn't quite often get letters that come all the way to his desk, but you rose to the occasion. So you got their attention. Yeah. It was good to see that they appreciated you, that you were given the responsibility that you were able to handle. How long were you in the Navy in total?
31 years.
31 years. 31 now, years. Can't you retire after 20?
Yeah, well, you can retire after 20.
And why did you stay longer?
Because I just really thoroughly enjoyed being in the Navy. I spent 25 of those 31 years at sea on board ships.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You still feel the sea rocking under your...
No, not really, but was my opinion. If you're going to be in the Navy, then you need to be a ship driver.
That's the top job. That's the top gun of the Navy.
I don't think there's any job in the United States that's or any place that's better than being a commanding officer of a Navy ship.
So during that time, was there any particular stories where you felt like this one really stands out, some experience that you had that you want to tell us about?
Well, there are...
Pick one.
Yeah, I'm trying to think...
Was there a time when the ship ever got attacked?
Oh yeah, we came under. Well, yeah, we one time in Vietnam we were bracketed with mortar rounds and
bracketed. What does that mean?
I mean they were falling all around us. You know,
okay.
They hadn't hit us yet, and they were falling all around us. And unfortunately, I always kept the ship in a position that we could move in a moment's notice, and so I kept the engines running, and so as soon as the first round landed, we got the ship ready to get underway, pulled up the anchor, and just start moving. And then we became a moving target. Fortunately, we didn't get hit.
That was good. So in order for them to actually send mortars out there, which are basically, those are they're not self-propelled. They're fired from a large cannon.
From the riverbank.
And yeah. when they get out there, then they explode bomb.
If they hit you, they would explode, yeah.
And that would be quite deadly.
Right, yeah, so.
And they didn't hit you, but they must have had you in their sights in order to...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With binoculars or something.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Aim at you and correct each time they see something. So.
Yeah, we had not a whole lot, but we had... We had small arm fire, you know,
they would aim at you from shore?
From shore, you know, and they punched holes in the side of the ship.
Okay. You didn't encounter any submarines or any other vessels?
No, these were up in the land. The rivers are just similar to what the Columbia River is like, you know, they're about that wide, and there's about five rivers down there,
So they could potentially still hit you even with small rounds from shore.
Yeah, they hit us with some small rounds, but fortunately, no. We only had we had one day we had one fatal casualty where a sniper shot one of our people through the head.
Really, from shore?
From shore
onto your ship.
So, all in all, it and we did we did a lot of. Of good over there. We would one of the things that I did that was really that I really like, we had the families of our sailors would send us clothes and toys and goodies and so forth, and we'd go up and down the rivers, and during lulls in action we would go over into the villages and give the people clothes and toys, children toys, and we would do what we called med caps. We would take one of our medical people, and he would go there and he'd give people shots.
Is this North Vietnam or
South
actually...
Vietnam?
Okay,
yeah. So we give people shots, and so.
That must have been some satisfying to be able to do.
It was very, very satisfying, and you know, you hear one of the stories that I like to tell is, you hear sometimes how cruel, you know, some of our sailors and soldiers and troops are and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I'm here to tell everybody that they're wonderful people. One time in the Vietnam waters, we had a what we called a Chu Hoi. It was a North Vietnamese person that wanted to surrender. And he was approaching us, my ship, in a sampan. And I told my gunner to fire some shots in his direction so he wouldn't come any closer. So we did, and he basically stopped. I put a boat in the water with a young officer and some riflemen and of course the boat operators, and told him to go out there and you know, capture that person and bring him back to the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And I also told him, I said, these people sometimes booby trap themselves, so if he does anything out of the ordinary, shoot him. Okay, don't take any chances of him blowing you up and him up and everything. So anyway, so our boat goes out there, and our boat's much bigger than his, little sampan. And as we turn to come alongside his sampan, well, of course, we create a wave action. And it makes his boat rock. And so when his boat rocks, his arms come down, and I'm watching through my binoculars, and his arms come down, and it maybe looked like he was could have been reaching for something, but I don't know, and so what did my young fellows do? They laid their weapons down on the engine cover on our boat, and went to help this guy to keep him from falling, and the thing of it is that our young people that their immediate response or their immediate action was...
Shoot him.
Not to shoot him, but...
Well, what I mean to say is that I was expecting that the natural thing, self-protection, would be to shoot him because he reached down to detonate something.
Yeah.
But instead, they responded with some compassion.
Yeah, they responded with compassion. And that's, you know, and that's what our young... 99% of our young people are that way, you know. And they're not what... some other people depict them as being, bad guys and whatnot.
So even knowing that there was a threat there, even though he could have been booby-trapped, even though his hands were going down to be able to, that could be a dangerous situation still, their humanity to humanity came through, helped him, brought him safely aboard.
Right. Because
of their character.
So, our young men and women that serve in the military are just wonderful people, and I would say in all my 31 years in experience with them, and I always tell my wife I raised thousands of teenagers, and they're just wonderful, caring people, and they've got a job to do, and they do it.
In other words, a lot of the young men. I assume, did they have young women serving back then?
We didn't have women on ships in those days.
Okay, so basically each time you were in command, all those were young men serving under your command.
Right.
They're young,
right.
And so you raised thousands of teenagers, they're still growing up.
Right.
And so they looked to you for leadership.
Right. Yeah, anyway, but yeah, it was a very, I can't think of anything I would have done with that part of my life than being in the Navy. I mean, it was one of the most rewarding things I've ever done.
Do you still stay in touch with some of those people?
Oh, yes. I still stay in touch with them. I go to ship's reunions, and not too long ago I went to a ship's reunion with hadn't seen some of the fellas in 50 years.
And you're still friends.
We're still friends, and we.
How do you address each other? They think of you as commander, or they think of you as Larry.
Some of them were. I was enlisted with them, so
So depending on where you were in their history.
Yes, and they don't care if I was a commander. Mm-hmm. We were just friends. So and we're still friends.
Right. So you're. I want to recognize your service to our country. So when I see you, I say, hey, Commander, is that okay?
Oh, yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay, you still have other people that do that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's good.
My wife does that sometimes.
You don't say that to her.
Well, very good.
Larry, you got some stories to tell as you were serving in the Navy. Tell us about one of those harrowing tales.
Well, one of the harrowing tales was... on my first trip on the first ship I had command of going to Vietnam, we had just left Pearl Harbor and were en route to the Philippines, as would be our next stop. And there was a typhoon up ahead of us. And so to avoid the typhoon, I changed course and headed south to go around the typhoon.
Typhoon mean you're in the southern hemisphere.
Yes,
hurricanes in the northern hemisphere, typhoons in the southern hemisphere, right?
So I and uh, And we're out there, and the wind's blowing, and it's raining, and the high seas and whatnot, and the ship goes dead in the water.
All the lights go out. Your engines quit.
The engines quit. The generators quit. Everything, and we're just bouncing around like a cork.
Because a typhoon is not too far away.
No, it's not too far away.
You got rough seas.
Rough seas, and so the engines quit, and we're bouncing around. And I've got a load of marine equipment on board and whatnot, and find out what's going on, and.
So even in that case, you're not able to orient your ship so that you're...
You can't do it. No, you're just at...
You're at the mercy of the waves. You could be taking waves the hard way and rolling like crazy.
And we survived that, but that was scary, and
how long do you think it took to get them going?
It took us a couple hours to get everything back. It was like a pilot error. The person on watch in one of the engine rooms forgot. On those diesel-driven ships, you purify the oil before you put it in the engine, mm-hmm. and so the oil goes from the fuel tank into what we call a day tank, which is where the engines get the oil from, is the day tank. Mm-hmm. And anyway, somebody forgot to fill the day tank.
Oh, oops.
And so it was.
So they finally figured it out. And you got the engines going again.
They got the engines going, and we survived.
Was there a cheer?
Yeah. And another one was when going across the Northern Pacific in wintertime in February, really raging seas, and we had pretty close to what I would call 100-foot seas. It was a huge storm.
Well,
and it just. My gyro tumbled. We had this hydrofoil tied down on deck, and we were afraid that was going to break loose. And about three quarters of the crew was seasick, and it was just really. And the thing of it is, being a commanding officer of a ship, When you're something other than commanding officer, when something like that happens, you got somebody to turn to, and the thing that dawned on me at first was when I got into somebody's things, before I was a commanding officer, you had somebody to turn to, but when I got into somebody's really tight situations,
You were Captain Kirk, right?
My first thought was look around and see if but there was nobody there to ask questions to. So what do you do?
You have to figure it out.
You have to make the decision, and you just hope you make the right one. So in that case,
you just simply wrote it out.
You adjust your speed and you adjust your course. And of course, it's better to head into the wind and seas than it is to have it on your beam or on your bow or something. So,
why is that?
Well, because if you're heading in seas, you'll go like this. Mm-hmm. But if it's on your beam, if it's on the side or something, the ship's going to roll like that.
What about if it's behind you? Mm-hmm. In other words, it doesn't matter which way the wave, as long as you're going perpendicular to the waves. Mm-hmm. You're not rocking back and forth to some violent roll.
You want to head. You're best off heading into it.
Did you ever get seasick?
No.
No.
Fortunately, I never did. But
it must be all those years working up to it.
But anyway, I got in trouble a couple times having women on board my ship because a couple of the commanders in the various areas that I went through, they were not aware of what the Chief of Naval Operations had given us permission to have women on board.
And you mean bringing wives or?
Yeah, the wives on board. And during that tour, anyway, fortunately, I had a liaison officer on board, and he smoothed things over so that.
When you finally got out, you got an honorable discharge. So you must that must have been okay to have some.
It's hard. hard to explain the comradeship that develops when you're, you know, I mean, well, like in Vietnam, my guys were confined to the ship for 7 months without ever getting off of it. And that's a long time to be on board the ship without.
They learn to get along, or
they get along, and you do. One of my favorite interesting stories was we were anchored in a river just south of Saigon, and I got woken up in the middle of the night, and and they told that there's an unidentified contact approaching us on a collision course.
You mean via water or air?
Yeah, via water. Well, you know, we had her on radar and it was closing us. So we didn't know what it was. So I got up and went up on the bridge, and sure enough, here's this something closing on us, and it had pretty rapid. So
you can see it via radar?
You can see it on radar.
Okay.
You know? So I got the ship underway. And put some boats in the water to go check it out. And it turned out it was a sand and gravel barge that belonged to the United States Army that had evidently broken loose and was floating down the river.
Nobody aboard.
It was just floating down the river. So I made a controlled collision with it and got it alongside my ship. And by the time we got all this done, it was becoming daylight. And so I had a brilliant idea, you know. On board Navy ships, you can't have alcohol at all. But I always carried about 500 cases of beer on board my ship. And so I got a brilliant idea, and I told my executive officer, I said, I want you to throw half a dozen cases of beer out on that sand out there, on that barge, and let a third of the crew go out there and have a beach party.
Okay. And I want to see how this unfolds.
And, you know, they did, and I kept that barge for about 4 days, and let everybody on board take a turn going out there on that sand barge, having a beach party.
Okay, so basically you're raising the morale of your troops there, because they've been on this vessel for so long, and you wanted to make sure that, hey, they're not going to consume all this alcohol on my ship, but I've got this barge with I got my own portable beach here.
Right.
Let them go have
morale. And then after everybody had their fill, I called up the Army and said, hey, if you want your barge, I got it. So, and they sent a tug down to pick it up.
Partially used.
So anyway, but that was, you know, but so there. I mean, there's those kinds of things that.
So you had some creativity to you.
Oh yeah, it's
that's a little feisty. Are you still a little feisty?
I
expect you, the men, they must have thought they got the greatest commander in the world at that point.
I always had very good rapport with the people that served with me. They were, you know.
You were in the respect.
My idea, and it was, I managed by walking around. I got to the point where I would wander through the ship at night, daytime, and talk to the guys. I got to where I knew them all by name. I knew their wives' names. I knew their children's names. And it served two purposes. One was that, you know, you get have a good relationship with them, and you gain a ton of knowledge about what's going on a ship. That what they inadvertently tell you. That
that's good. So you engaged with people. You were out there making sure that they knew you. You knew them. Mm-hmm. Close the communication gap. So you weren't remote. You were not aloof. You were actually the guys. You were tuned in, which is a very, very important part of any kind of leadership.
Yeah, and it worked very well, and it had very good luck.
Great. Now, at one point, after 31 years, you decided to retire. What led to that decision?
Well, I put in for retirement, and my boss told me that if I would stay in the Navy, he would give me a job as a commanding officer, as an executive officer on one of those, they had built new amphibious aircraft carriers. And he'd give me a job as an executive officer on there. And then from there, if everything worked out well, I would get promoted to captain, and I would get a job as a commanding officer of another ship. And I said, that's another 5 or 6 years at sea. And so.
So they didn't want to lose you even after 31
yeah,
years.
So I said,
you said, I'd like to retire, and they said, hey, we're going to offer you these deals.
So I said, I've spent so many years at sea, so it's time to get out and spend some time with my family and my kids. And,
sure. Well, that speaks well of your service when they will try to offer you enticements to stay in longer. Yeah, at that point, I expect you were a senior member. You had all this experience. You had a good track record. And it was smart for them to try to recruit you and stay in longer. Yeah. But 31 years, that's 11 past the 20 years of retirement.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, yeah. But, Navy, like any place else, you develop a reputation. And, and the officer's corps in the Navy is not all that great. I mean, there's not that many people. I mean, I was in the surface Navy, and then, of course, you got the air part, the aviator. They have their own Navy, and then you got submarine Navy. But in the one that I was in, it's fairly small group. So you get people know who you are and what you do. And
so it's a small world in that area. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you retired from the Navy, and that must have been a change in you were Mr. Somebody. And anytime he leaves a position at the top and they retire, now you're no longer, all those people that used to report to you, they're not reporting to you anymore. Mm. Did that take some getting used to?
No, I think I adapted very well. I went and I applied for a job at the Port of Portland.
So you retired to Portland or Vancouver?
I retired here in Portland.
Oh, is that right? What year was that?
In 1978.
And so you've been in the Portland, Vancouver area since 78.
Right.
And you called this home. Why did? Is this where you came from? Why did you call?
No,
this?
I was.
Why'd you settle here?
Because my wife was here.
This was her home area.
Yeah. So anyway, my wife was here, and so. And so I decided to stay here. I brought a ship up here to the Navy Yard for overhaul. And
while I was in the
Navy, yeah. I brought the ship up here for overhaul, and then from here I went to Westpac, that went back to the Pacific, and decided that I was going to retire, so I arranged to retire in Hong Kong.
That was where you, in other words, that's where you made the decision. Yeah. But you're going to decide to retire here.
Well, yeah, I decided to retire and have my change of command ceremony in Hong Kong, and my wife flew out to Hong Kong, and I retired and came and transferred myself to Portland. So I came here and went to work for the Port of Portland. And
what doing what?
Well, I started out at Terminal 4 as a superintendent, and about a year later, after I retired there, the port owns and operates a dredge.
Okay, I got a question for you. When you retired after 31 years in the Navy. Doesn't that they pay you something? You get a monthly income.
Yeah, I get. Yeah, I get,
so you could have just said, "Hey, this is my retirement. I put in my years. Yeah. I'm going to just stay retired." But instead, you decided to go to work.
Right. Yeah.
And why is that? Why did you decide to go to work?
Well, I enjoy being active. I don't think I could. I don't think I could.
You like to be a productive guy.
Yeah. And so I went and the dredge sunk alongside the pier.
Whoops.
And.
You mean
and
it
of course,
wasn't supposed to sink,
everybody that was involved with it got fired,
okay.
And so they raised it and restored it.
What was the? Why did it sink?
Well, somebody left the pump open, and what happened? Somebody left the pump open,
and it backflowed out.
And and a dredge has got what they call spuds on it. And so when the tide went out, and the pump door was open, so when the tide went out, the dredge came down on the spuds.
And
when the
holes.
Tide came back in, the dredge, of course, is trying to come up, and it got locked on the spud somehow, and the ship, and it didn't come up with the tide, and the water entered in through the pump hole and into the engine room, and it sunk like a rock.
Oh boy!
And so anyway, so they were looking. They fired. I guess they fired the key people, and I applied for the job.
Okay, so that was before you got there.
That was before I got there.
Big oops.
I came after they had it ready to go back to work. I applied for the job and I got it and spent 21 years doing that.
Really?
Yeah.
You spent another 21 years. And again, your position was with the port. You were a manager.
I was a manager of the port's navigation division.
And did you must have enjoyed it after staying that long.
Oh, yeah, it was great. Again, I had a great group of people working for me. And we became very famous when Mount St. Helens erupted.
Why is that?
Well, because when Mount St. Helens erupted, the river was blocked at Longview. We had about 23 ships stranded in the Portland-Vancouver area. They couldn't get out.
Because of mud flows?
Mud flow, yeah. The river depth at the Longview area in the channel was like 12 feet.
Oh, because there was a river that intersected Columbia at that point, and all that mud flow
it blocked off the river. So we spent about 2 years after that working.
Dredging that out?
Dredging it out. But we had the river open for ship traffic in probably 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah, we dug one side of the channel. We cleared it so it would be deep enough for ships to get out. There was the port's dredge, and then the Corps had three smaller dredges and all working in this one area, and we got it opened up.
Right, so you got the job done. You know how to make light work of it, it sounds like.
So anyway, when I was working for the port, I joined an organization called the Western Dredging Association,
okay,
which covers the Western Hemisphere.
And why would you join that?
Well, because it's involved in dredging, and I was in dredging, and so...
Just to share information, to network?
Well, dredging, that association is an educational association.
Okay.
We promote the exchange of information that relates to dredging, navigation, and marine engineering and whatnot. So I joined that organization, and I went to a meeting up in Vancouver, British Columbia,
mm-hmm.
and I was a new kid on the block, and they needed somebody to be a membership chairman. So I said, well, I'll do that. So I became membership chairman, and I gathered up every mailing list I could find of people who were associated with dredging and sent them a free membership. And send them a letter and told them that, you know, if they like us, I'll send them a bill for next year. And so we start growing, and got a lot of good returns from the free memberships. And a couple of years later, somebody called me up and said, "How'd you like to be the president of the organization?" And I said, "Yeah, why not?" So I became the president. And then a few years later than that, my predecessor. Decided that he was going to retire, and so the gentleman who was with the Corps headquarters in Washington, D.C., and was basically the founder of this organization, called me up and said, "I want you to take George's place." And I said, "Okay." And so I took that over. So
you were heading it up now.
And
you seem to rise to the top in a lot of these situations.
and so now I'm the executive director of the Western Dredging.
You still are.
So and I've been doing that for years. So
is that right? And so what does that involve?
It involves putting on basically conferences. We partner with Texas A&M University, which has a very great dredging curriculum. And we put on about a four-day conference annually for the Western Hemisphere. And then we have, I have seven chapters. I got four in North America, I got one in Panama, one in Mexico, and one in Rio.
So you must travel.
I do a lot of traveling. I do, and we're also part of a larger organization that...
So you have an active passport and you've got stamps on that thing.
So anyway, but... How
long are you going to stay with that?
Well, as you know, I just talked to the board of director people here recently, and you know, as long as my health holds out, and I feel,
and you're in good health,
I'm in good health, and you know.
And what does your wife think of all this? She likes?
Yeah, she's good. She gets to travel with me most of the time.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I bet you she likes that part of that.
Well, for instance, last year we went to we had a conference in Beijing, China. I had one in Rio de Janeiro, we had one in Panama, and one in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and plus we had four in North America.
So you were
lesser meetings.
Quite the world traveler.
Yeah. So anyway, and I do most of the negotiating and planning for I negotiate with the resorts or hotels or wherever we have about 50 or 60 exhibitors at our show. We have about 300 to 500 people come to our show, and we exchange a lot of really good information as it relates to dredging.
Do you still get involved or are you aware of the contracts and how the ports will be employing dredging even on the Columbia and Willamette or?
Yeah. Yeah, I was very much involved in the deepening of the Columbia River. Started that back in the 80s before I retired from the port. And
deepening to from what to what?
The authorized depth was 40 feet. Now the authorized depth is 43 feet. So we deepened the authorized depth another 3 feet. So.
And does that periodically fill up with silt and you got to go back and,
dredge it?
Well,
it does fill up with silt, so there's some areas of the river that need to be dredged every year, some every other year, some maybe not only every 5 years, but there's dredging that needs to be done in the river.
So you must know a lot about these rivers here, where the channels are. And
Pretty much, yeah. I spent 21 years riding up and down the river and
Have you been on any of those tugs that go up and down the river?
Yeah, I've been on tugs. I've been on the Corps hopper dredges. Corps got two hopper dredges here, and it's a good and I tell everybody if we ever stop dredging, their shelves will be empty in about 2 or 3 months. Because of we have such a global economy now that
you need to be able to get those ships up and down there.
Right. So
so that dredging goes on all the way through the mouth of the river, right?
Oh yeah, it goes all the way throughout the river, and there's dredging. So
now just looking here, we've got the channel that goes up and down the Columbia River as it crosses the 5 freeway and through the railroad rotary gate there. There must be two channels through there for through the high gate at the high span of the bridge and through the lift span of the bridge. Mm-hmm. Are there other is any other area under the 5 bridge dredged?
The 43-foot channel only goes up to the bridge. It doesn't go beyond it.
Oh, okay, and then it drops down to
about 12 feet.
12 feet.
That's probably, when I say 12 feet, that's probably the controlling depths. Parts of the river from here up to the Idaho border are probably 12 feet. So about the only thing you can get up there is barges and small boats.
So when you see these tugs going up down the river with the barges, what kind of depth do they need?
They use 10 feet.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was that shallow. So they could pick wherever they want, they can pick the high span or the lift span to be able to go through there. How much does that river go up and down in its water level?
Up in this area, up in our area, about a foot, maybe foot to 2 feet.
That's all?
That's all. Up there, the tidal effect up here is about a foot.
Now, there's different times when the water flow is very swift, and I understand that those vessels, the tugs, they can't negotiate that S-curve to go underneath the high span and then get over to the north side of the river and go through the that swing, what do you call that, that railroad swing?
Yeah, the swing bridge. That's a swing bridge,
When does that, what time of year does
That's about the time of year we are right now, because as soon as, with the weather warming up, we're going to have, we've got a lot of snow in the mountains, and they're going to, and it's going to smelt. And it's going to, they're going to start melting, and the river levels will come up, and we've had near floods. We have had near floods a couple of times here, and what happened was, during the snow melt, we've had a warm rain, which causes the snow to melt even faster, and probably faster than they can control it.
So even when you have that that snow melt, and you got the swift flow, the water still normally stays within a foot or so.
No, the water will come up. We had what was it, about 96, I think. We came within inches of flooding the Boise Cascade property there. The river was up about 20 some feet.
And maybe you're going to go over the dike there?
Yeah, go over to the right.
Now, how high, we got a high span on that bridge and a lift span. What is the clearance between the water level and the high span?
I'm not sure. I'm not really sure what it is, but it's not very much, because we even have to open a bridge for a sailboat with a pretty good, mast.
Yeah, I've seen sailboats go up in there, but I've seen a lot of the commercial traffic go through the high span, and most of the sailboats with the, all of them are the high span, or with the mast, have to go through the lift. So that we get to talk a little bit about some of your local passion. I've seen you try to get our elected officials to listen to you, and you have some passion about this current project that they're proposing. Can you tell us about that? What's going on? You've been a well-respected person through history. You've served in time of war. You've been commanders of ships, and you've handled authority well. You're a war veteran. Of the United States here, and so I want to make sure you get recognized for your service to our country. With that service to your country, you value our Constitution, you value the rights that our military has defended over the years, and how do you feel like, why are you so involved in our local area here?
Well, I've been involved for years, even when I was working for the Port of Portland. I was very much involved with the with what's going on in the area, and I guess I think one of my passions is I'm appalled at the wasteful spending of tax dollars, and I've seen it throughout every one of my careers. I've seen it in the military, I've seen it when I worked for the Port of Portland, and I see it now with the City of Vancouver and the CRC project and so forth. And I just find it really, really bothersome that politicians, and I think that it's getting worse, ignoring the voice of the people and just spending money however they want without any consideration for what it does to the taxpayers.
Well, one of the races that you were involved in not too long ago was our mayoral race for mayor, where we had Mayor Pollard, that was our mayor, and then Tim Leavitt was elected. Were you involved in that race at all?
Very much so. Matter of fact, I sometimes think that that I'm responsible for Mayor Leavitt being mayor.
How's that?
Well, Mayor Leavitt and Mayor Pollard were pretty much tied at the end of the primary. They and I convinced a friend of mine named Charlie Stemper to run for mayor.
Okay.
And my purpose in that was to split the vote, which we did. We were successful in splitting the vote. Neither one of them got enough votes, you know, to win. So they were going to have a runoff.
Okay. Why would you want to split the vote? Who would you prefer to win?
I've had issues with Mayor Pollard for years.
Okay.
And so
you saw waste and you feel like, hey, I'm going to change the leadership.
A change of leadership. And so, and I've had numerous breakfast meetings with Mayor Leavitt and so forth. So after the primary, we were asked, Charlie and I, we were asked to support one or the other, you know.
So the top two were Mayor Leavitt, or at that time, Council Member Leavitt,
and
Pollard.
Pollard, yeah. They both wanted us to endorse them.
Okay.
And so anyway, for obvious reasons, we hadn't had no luck with Mayor Pollard. As a matter of fact, several years ago, I've had a petition to. And was successful petition drive to allow us to vote on whether or not we should build the Hilton Hotel and a convention center and a hockey rink with taxpayer dollars. Successful, and the city took us to court, and of course, with court overturned our signatures for whatever reason, and Pollard told us that. In response to a question by one of the other council members, Mayor Pollard said that he would not help the enemy. He accused us of being the enemy.
Okay, so you were decided that you're going to support Tim Leavitt for mayor. How did you support him? Did you end up endorsing him?
We ended up endorsing him, and myself and several other of my friends, we put up many of his signs around town, and we had breakfast meetings with him. We counseled him, we talked to him, so forth and so on. And
why did you support him? I know that you had some negative experiences, some differences with the incumbent mayor. Were there any promises or any?
Yeah, well, yes, there was.
What did you expect from Tim Leavitt?
I expected to have a more transparent city council. I expect that, and I was led to believe that we would have, that we would have his ear. That he, you know, we didn't ask him to do anything, but we wanted him to listen to us.
Mm-hmm.
I asked him that in return for our endorsing him, that Charlie be given a fair shot at the vacant seat. I said, I don't want him to be. You know, I don't expect that he'll get the job as filling your vacant seat, but I'd like him to be in the running because, you know, so. And
so if Tim Leavitt became mayor, then he would leave behind a vacant city council position.
Yeah.
And so you asked Tim Leavitt to nominate Charlie Stemper for that vacant position.
Right, yes. And I said, if you do that, I said, we'll vote for, we'll have our people vote for
you.
And
did he agree to that?
He agreed to that.
Are you sure you understood his?
I understood it perfectly.
So he made a commitment to you too.
He made a commitment, and the night of the when they nominated people, he called me up and told me that he was very sorry, but Charlie didn't get nominated. And I said, well, wait a minute. I said, we had a deal. I said, you promised. He said, well, the other council members didn't feel like they could work with Charlie. I said, I don't care what the other council members thought. I said, he should have at least, even if he didn't get the nomination, you should have nominated him, because that's what we said, because Charlie had about 3,200 votes, I think it was, and Leavitt beat Pollard by about 3,000 votes. And we worked real hard to get Charlie's people to vote for Leavitt, so So anyway, but he insisted that it wouldn't do any good, that the other council members would not have Charlie because they didn't feel that they could work with him. So,
and well, if that be the case, then they could vote against it. But it doesn't hurt to nominate, especially if you give your word.
So anyway, so that and I told Mayor Leavitt when and I became kind of notorious for dueling with Mayor Pollard over the years. And I told Mayor Leavitt, I said, if you go back on your promise, I said, if you think I was tough on Mayor Pollard, I said, you wait and see how tough I'm going to be with you. I said, because, you know, I just don't appreciate people going back on their word, you know, because,
Your word is your bond. So you understood that was a commitment.
As far as I was concerned, that was a commitment. And there were five or six other people there with us, with me.
So it wasn't a misunderstanding.
No,
he just didn't nominate.
No, and he just said he said nobody would come forth, and so I just.
How'd that make you feel?
No, that made me feel like a fool.
Taken advantage of, or?
I think it was taken advantage of because we worked real hard in good faith and he told me, he told us that all of these things were, you know, things were going to change, and I told him that, I'm a small businessman. I got a building that I'm trying to restore and open up a business there, and I told him, you know, there's so much red tape, so much paper, and so forth, so on. He said he's going to change that, but nothing has changed. Matter of fact, it's gotten worse, I think.
So you're a businessman, and the whole thing we need in this community is jobs. Yeah. And your experience is that you're trying to invest in your business, and you found it very difficult. What about the other expectations, the other promises or commitments that you had understood from candidate Leavitt? Did any of those pay out?
I don't see any of them paying out, I don't see any transparency. I don't see any openness. I don't see any listening. Matter of fact, I think the mayor and most of his council there have taken a position that they're all in lockstep and. No matter what you say or what you do, you get the same answer back almost verbatim every time.
My experience is just recent. Mm-hmm. You've been involved with the city council for many years. You know about the gavel down mm-hmm. incident and that mm-hmm. kind of just the kind of mm-hmm. really extraordinary behavior that has made Vancouver somewhat notorious. Is that more than what it's been in the past, or have there been some shenanigans in the past that?
It hasn't gotten any better. Might have gotten worse. When they were talking about building the Hilton Hotel and the hockey rink and so forth. They formed a public facility district. Public facility district was authorized to siphon off 0.033% of the sales tax collected in the city of Vancouver to build a hotel or hockey rink or whatever else instead of sending it to Olympia. And of course, my argument was, if you're going to shortchange Olympia, then they're going to raise our taxes. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But anyway, they were bound to determine they were going to build this hockey rink and this convention center and et cetera. We had several meetings with this public facility district, and they needed to get $10 million in matching funds for the hockey rink.
From where?
From private industry or whatever, and so the former president of Bank of Clark County, Mike Worthy, came forward and said that he had a group of anonymous people that would donate this money for the thing. But he demanded that he have seven things. He demanded that he get the naming rights, the food and beverage, the security, the advertising, and couple.
So you put $10 million into it, and you get some benefits out of it.
Gets all of that. And I jump up, and I said, you can't do that. And he said, yes, we can. I said, no, you can't. I said, if you do that, I said, the city cannot enter into an agreement with a group of anonymous people. And so I filed a Freedom of Information request and to get all the documents that had to do with this. And so when I got these... when I got these documents, I ran across one from Jerry Jenkins, who was the developer that wanted to build a hockey rink and all of those things, to Steve Burdick, who was the city's economic development manager, that said my son Corey says that we have to put out an RFP. What's an RFP? And so Burdick went back to him and said, to keep Patella from suing us for violating the state law, we got to put out an RFP, and Mike's okay with that. Well, and so I gathered up all this information, all the information I had, and I sent it all off to the Attorney General and several other people,
Did you get any response?
Oh yeah, got some response, and about 2 or 3 weeks after I sent all the stuff off at a meeting, at an ex-PFD meeting, Public Facility District meeting, Mike Worthy gets up and said that his days as a banker may be numbered. And I didn't even know we had a financing commissioner or whatever he was up north, but I found out they had one, and I sent him all. And he said his banking days may be numbered because he had to hire a lawyer because he was being investigated. And shortly thereafter...
Who was investigating him? All you did was write a letter to the Attorney General.
I guess he was being investigated by the banking commissioner, okay. Whoever else. I'm not sure. I never did find out. But shortly thereafter, they dropped the hockey rink idea.
Okay. So just to be fair, we want to make sure that the fact that he was investigated doesn't necessarily mean he was convicted of a crime or he was guilty of a crime.
No.
It just, you, as a citizen, you just simply try to get information out in the open and just make sure everything is above board. And so there was some question there.
Right.
And so you don't want to imply there was any crime. At this point, the hockey rink did not get built.
Did not get built.
But the hotel did.
Well, the hotel, and we collected enough petition signatures to put the hotel to a vote.
Really?
Yeah.
So was that your first time you had circulated a petition?
And the city took us to court.
Why would they take you to court?
They took us to court because they
did
said
did you
our,
do something wrong?
Well, they said that the first time they took us to court, they said our petition signatures were not properly notarized.
So you'd gone through all the whole process. Did you get enough signatures to put it on?
Oh, yeah. We had enough signatures.
So you went through all, as far as you knew, you went through all that work, gathered all those signatures, presented it to the council? What'd you do with it?
Presented it to the city clerk. City clerk presented it to the county auditor, who verified the signatures.
Okay.
They were proved to be sufficient and proper, and then it was presented to the city. Well, the city,
and so that again, that was to what did that measure say? What did your petition say?
That measure said that we wanted to vote. Basically, it said we wanted to vote on the whether or not they spend like $73 million to build the Hilton Hotel.
So basically, you were just simply as an active citizen, wanting the people of the city to be able to say whether or not the city's going to spend this 70-some million dollars to build a hotel.
Right. And so city took us to court.
And they could have just simply said, well, this is something that we can ask the voters because obviously there's enough voters that have signed this petition that says so. They could have done that,
They could have done that. But so they took us to court, and a couple other angles there. And in the court, Judge Harris was the judge. I think he just retired recently. Judge Harris was the judge. And during the trial, we had hired a lawyer, and it cost my little group, it cost us $60,000.
Your little group. In other words, you guys are, this is all out of your own pockets,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, out of our own pockets, yeah. We spent hours up at the rest stop up in Richfield there, was serving coffee and making money and doing however else we could come up with nickels and dimes. But we got the bill paid off.
And they're fighting you with tax dollars.
Yeah, they're fighting us with tax. So anyway, but the Judge Harris said that Ted Gathy and Brent Boger, who were the attorneys for the city, said that they were misleading the court. Well, I went to Brent Black's Law Dictionary, and misleading legally is to lie. And Ralph Peabody and I, we filed a complaint with the Washington Bar Association. I sent him a copy of the tape with our complaint, and about 3 months later, they came back and told us that, and the court had already overturned our petition.
So they
voided our signatures.
All of this work that you had done to gather the signature to be able to present a vote to the people got overturned on a technicality.
Right.
So there was never any vote. They just simply built it.
There was no vote, and so
spent the money.
And the Washington Bar Association said there was not enough evidence to substantiate our grievance or whatever. And I filed an appeal with the appellate court, and I was just about to get a date, and my oldest daughter was discovered with cancer. And so I dropped everything that I was doing, and nobody else picked it up. I dropped that, and I took her to several, around the country, several things to try to help her, but poor thing was too far gone, and she eventually passed away. And so the next time we came up, we collected petition signatures again to not build the hotel without a vote.
In other words, you ran another petition from scratch,
right? And
slightly different wording or something to satisfy the detail that they're looking for.
Yeah, we had to notarize things out, and so we collected enough signatures. We went through the same drill. It went to the city council, and they decided to take us to court again. And we didn't
instead
have any more.
Instead of approving it.
And so we didn't have any more money. So I acted as a lawyer for our side. And I still got the book at home. I had about that many
documents
that I wanted to present to the court. And it was a lady judge that time. And so we appeared in court. And the city made their opening statements. And I made our opening statements. And the city has said that our petition was confusing and ambiguous, and all it said was we want to vote. And so the judge heard our opening arguments. She retired to her chamber, came back in about a half hour, and she agreed with the city that our petition was confusing and ambiguous. And so we never got to present our case. We never got to show all of our documents.
That must have been so frustrating.
No, it was very, very frustrating. And following that, which is one of the things that made me really, and I've still got it on tape, but one of the things that irritated me with Mr. Pollard was that at a council meeting following that, one of the council members said that what this tells us is that the people want to have a voice in what's going on. And Pollard said that he said he didn't care. He has no intention of helping the enemy.
So, well, you're in the middle of circulating another petition, right?
Right, yeah.
And what does this petition say?
This petition asks for us for a vote on light rail, and says that should that it be put to a vote, and if the voters vote no, that they don't want it, then the city cannot use any city resources whatsoever, and it lists all of them. Mm-hmm. Cannot use any city resources mm-hmm. To fund the operation and maintenance of light rail. But it also says if the people vote against the petition, then the city is free to go ahead and do whatever they need to use the petition. So
again, it's to enable the people
to have a
vote.
All we're looking for is a vote.
So you're not saying stop this. You're just saying let the people decide.
Let the people vote, yeah.
And how many petitions or how many signatures have you collected so far?
I'm not sure. We got a lot of papers out there.
So you've been through it twice, so you know about what the process goes. So you're a pretty tenacious, committed guy.
Yeah.
And because you don't want to see waste, you want to be able to see, you believe in... And people having a voice of how they're going to spend these large sums of money. In this case, we're talking about a billion-plus expenditure of tax dollars for light rail project.
Yeah. So.
And so the question, it doesn't seem to be what is the dollar amount. I mean, $1 billion is plenty big enough for a local project like this to dictate a good idea if the customers, which are the users here, have a voice.
And I don't think we'll get this on the ballot, even if we collect enough petition signatures, because the whole system is it works against us, because we have to collect the signatures. We have to have them in the city clerk somewhere around June 10th. Then it has to go to the county auditor, the signatures to be verified. Then it's got to go to the city council, and they have 60 days to decide what they're going to do. They have several options. One option is they can put it on a ballot as is. They could put a companion ordinance on the ballot, or they could take us to court. Whatever, and my feeling is that if we're successful, they'll take us to court again.
Okay, if they wanted to, they don't need a petition in order to put this to a vote, right?
No,
they can just simply say, citizens, do you authorize the city to be able to use city resources to support this light rail crossing project?
Right.
They can say that without a petition, right?
Right. Yeah.
So they don't need citizens to try to force this vote. They could do that just simply with a council meeting.
I doubt seriously if they will.
Yeah. So what can we do, Larry? Commander?
Well, I think what we can do is we can, I think we can just keep this ball up in the air and educate people, and hopefully in this coming election we can get some people in there who would truly represent the voters.
Sure. Now there is a consensus almost entirely on this city, on the Vancouver City Council. And the one dissenter is the one that stands alone, it seems, is Jeannie Stewart. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about Jeannie Stewart? Is she a good council member?
Oh, yeah. I think she's marvelous. I've known her for several years. I've worked with her. She's as honest and truthful as the day is long.
And she seems to be there to sacrifice. I think she's been like 9 or 10 years she's been serving in that capacity. And it seems to me she's a good example of a citizen serving for sacrificial purposes. She can't be bought, won't sell us out, willing to listen to anyone. That's been my short-term experience as well. You've known her a lot longer.
Yeah, she's very, very...
So if you're having to fight City Hall all this time, the hard way is to try to force them to do something they don't want to do. That's with your petitions. Mm-hmm. I would think that the easier way is to get like-minded people elected to office. Yeah, And so we got in June, we have people to register for a primary. And if people are interested to do that, then how do they contact you? How did they do that? You got an email address? Or you got a cell phone number you want to share?
I got an email address with
what is it?
With about 2,000 people on it.
Okay. Well, what about if they want to email you? How would they do that?
They'll just email to lmpatella@comcast.net.
LM, like?
LM.
Larry Mary?
Larry Mary, yeah. Larry Mary.
What's your middle name?
Matthew.
Matthew, like Larry Matthew Patella.
Right, yeah.
That's P-A, how do you spell your last name?
P-A-T-E-L-L-A. Okay. Just like your kneecap.
At Comcast.net. And they can email and say, I'm interested, or I support you, or I oppose you. You're not afraid to let people speak. Yeah, in fact, that's all you're trying to do, is just let them speak.
Right.
Okay, well, that would be helpful. Hopefully, we'll get some more participation, that we can have some engagement with our local community and find out, do people support or oppose this? And the best way to do that is, let's have a vote.
All right.
So,
that's good.
Congratulations. Yeah. I respect you, sir. And not everybody has to agree with how politics are, what issues are, but you have service that you offer to our country. You're a war veteran. And you are engaging, you